I'm Julie Hantman with Climate Seasons, a show about climate change airing every 3 months here on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM. Today is my 11th episode. Recordings of past episodes can be found at my website, climateseasons.org. That's climateseasons.org, with topics ranging from local flooding risks in the DC area, youth activism, psychology, art, and more. Now, our topic today is communicating with a serious twist, or shall I say, a humorous twist. And my guest is Peterson Toscano, who does more things than is humanly possible. He is a playwright, actor, character actor, performance artist, Bible scholar, LGBTQ rights activist, climate activist, podcaster, and a self-described quirky queer Quaker. Welcome, Peterson, to the show.
Julie, thanks so much for having me. I'm just so excited to be on another climate show. Thank you for doing the show.
That's right. Popping from your show to mine. Redundancies are good. So did you tell me earlier, Peterson, before we started, that someone else was going to come along with you to the show? Who is that gentleman?
Yeah, Joey Bufuzio. That's the good thing about being a character actor. You don't always have to show up alone.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm glad and welcome to him. We'll hear from him soon. For the moment, briefly, I will zoom through a very quick summary of this hour for those who like to know what's coming next. In this hour, Peterson will show you how to spice up the otherwise dreary notion of talking about climate change in a lively way, and with the help of his characters and clips from his podcast. And Peterson will say four things, basically, in my view. Find what matters most to you when thinking about impacts of climate change, and then weave a positive personal message that will land with others. Third, let's all confront the big feelings we have about the climate and climate change. And finally, find your people, find your community. So all that being said, I've described what you do, Peterson, but please, would you tell us more about you and your journey?
I have the pleasure and the privilege of talking about really hard issues and using comedy and storytelling to do it. Comedy is a weird thing, right? It could make light of an issue, but it also has the power to shed light on an issue. And I learned this years ago in the early noughties, 2003, 2004, when I did a lot of work about the dangers of conversion therapy. This is those Pray Away the Gay programs. I was trapped in one of those for 17 years before I came to my senses. I knew I needed to bear witness, but it was a dreary, heavy story. I realized that by using comedy and storytelling, it relaxed people. Then, when I saw a real uptick of anti-trans violence among LGBT people, well, more L and G people, lesbians and gays, I realized I needed to talk to my own people about gender. And as a Bible scholar, I began to look at gender nonconforming Bible characters. And again, I used storytelling and at times humor to talk about gender issues. And now, climate change. Since 2012, I've been really, really concerned about climate change, as we all should be and are. And I take it incredibly seriously. But I recognize it is a field that desperately needs a lot of humanity and heart and humor. Again, not to make light of it, right, but to shed light on it.
I hear that. I completely agree. I myself briefly was stunned into paralysis when I first really confronted the climate crisis, and still haven't found a good way to lighten it. And I wish I could, so maybe I can. Then I could talk to more people. Right now, I'm a little bit stuck on this show talking to anonymous, invisible folks. I want to talk to my family. I want to talk to my friends. So help me out here. Could you bring to us now your friend from the Bronx, I believe, and maybe he can help set us on the right path to thinking and talking about climate change.
This is Tony Bufuzio from the Bronx. How you doing? I'm very excited about being here, although they gave me climate change. Thanks a lot. People freak out when they hear climate change. All right, folks, listen. All right, relax. We're not dead in the water yet, okay? There are solutions. We haven't got the hell in a handbasket. All right, we could be honest. We know that the crap's going to hit the fan, but we don't yet know how much crap and how big of a fan we're going to need to deal with it. So, you know, there's lots of questions that remain. Now, I don't know about you, but I've noticed ever since this climate thing started, there's been this huge uptick of polar bear imagery in the world and on the internet. And these photographers, they're amazing. They take these photographs of these polar bears on ice floes. They tell whole stories. And it tugs at your heart, right? Like, it really, like, pulls your heartstrings. Like, you want to, like, go over and hug it, right? No, you don't want to hug it. It will rip you to shreds. They're very dangerous creatures. Still, it's sad, the polar bears. They're losing their habitat. So, you know, it's shrinking. So they have to go off on land and to get food in landfills and garbage cans. They've actually become a real nuisance in Alaska. They become like the raccoons of Alaska. I personally don't like polar bears, all right? They're disgusting, they're dangerous, the second most privileged white mammal on the planet. And, you know, the thing is, the climate isn't just warming up in the Arctic. I mean, it is, but it's also warming in Central America. Yeah, where there's this disease, this fungus that's spreading like wildfire, attacking coffee plants. It's called coffee leaf rust. It's a real thing. Look it up. Now, it's going to sound awful, but I think I could live without polar bears. But a world without coffee? That's a dystopian future that I can't face.
Mr. Vufuzio, thank you for your message. I drink coffee, well, sometimes, and that hits me. But maybe other things hit me too. Is that, Peterson, is that the point here?
Yeah, the point is a couple. One is that some people are deeply moved by the polar bears, and they're in it for that. They're moved by maybe their grandchildren. I was someone who, you know, was concerned about the polar bear, but it didn't move me to the place of I needed to do something about it. My breakthrough came about when I realized that grain, wheat, was threatened because on a warmer planet, you're going to have crop failures, and there's a potential that there could be a failure of wheat production globally at some point, or all kinds of crops. And I read an article where, you know, potentially pasta is at risk. And I'm Italian American. And the idea of, like, suddenly pasta being super expensive, not readily available, difficult to get, it did something to me. I mean, it made it real. And I think that's important for some of us, not all of us. Some people could just look at the data and they freak out. But for some of us, this is such a big issue. You need a foothold. So when you find out that something that is part of your culture, your life, your everyday experience, that that's threatened, it can help break through in a deeper way. It's not the only way that people are moved by climate change, but I have to say, that one monologue that I do, I've done all over North America and in the UK, after I do that, there's inevitably at least one or several people that come up to me and say, so the coffee thing, is that real? Because it hit them in a visceral gut place, which is important. I understand, you know, letting people know the truth about climate change, but it also has to be something that they can understand in their own lives.
And just one thing, not five.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that is one of the mistakes, that listing off, you know, when people, you know, and I understand, again, why we do this, right? There's the wildfires and the sea level rise. No. So many climate experts that do communication make it very clear that it's important to talk about the impacts of climate change. Typically one impact and maybe how it affects people in that region, and then begin to talk about solutions, mm-hmm. Pivot to the solutions. And it's not about giving false hope. You know, it's about saying this is real, but there are things we can do, because if we paint the picture too bad, I mean, and that's our job in part, without giving people something they can do, then they're like, well, why should I even care? I don't have the energy to care if I can't do something about it.
You said it, Peterson, and that's what we're going to go into after the next musical break. And this is Julie Handman with Climate Seasons here on Tacoma Radio, 94.3 FM, WOWDLP, with our guest today, Peterson Toscano, climate educator, performer, and much more. Okay, Peterson, we heard from Mr. Vufuzio about coffee and how much he likes coffee and how he's endangered by the lack of coffee in the future. But how can we make our climate conversations really land on people's ears and hearts?
Well, there's a couple of important things here. Part of it is about speaking within a relationship. I mean, if you're looking for the silver bullet talking point, forget it. There's no such thing. People listen to people with whom they trust and they have a relationship with. So part of it is about building that relationship and getting to know that person and what is meaningful to them. This is, in a way, one of the powerful things about climate change is it affects everything. So if you have a friend who's very concerned about people living on the streets, a houseless population, if you have a friend who's very concerned about domestic violence, if you have a friend who's concerned about pets, all of these areas where people have passions and so many more, they're all impacted by climate change. For a time, I was a member of a YMCA in central Pennsylvania where I would do water walking in the morning because I had a very bad back. And it was an incredibly older conservative crowd. And I just really wanted to talk about climate change because that's all I want to talk about. But I didn't. I first just talked about pets for about 3 months. Got to know everything about their pets, would ask them about their pets, see photos about their pets when we got out of the pool. And then once we got to know each other, I got to know their pets, then I began sharing with them how I had interviewed a veterinarian for Citizens Climate Radio about the impacts of climate change on pets and how we can protect them. Suddenly they were curious. Because one, they trusted me, right? I didn't just immediately start with the climate change. They knew I was interested in their pets and they care about their pets. And they then started peppering me with questions. And I think that's one of the things is people have lots of strong feelings about climate change, but one is not curiosity. So it's important to help people be curious about climate change. Very often when I'm speaking in front of a group, and I know it's a more progressive crowd, there might be some LGBTQ folks in the crowd or allies. I'll often say that, you know, I'm concerned about climate change for lots of reasons, but particularly because it's an LGBTQ issue. But then I move on. I never say anything more. And inevitably, someone is just itching and they raise their hand. They're like, wait, I need to stop you. How is this an LGBTQ issue? And then I'm thrilled because they're curious.
Yeah. So you can frame it as any sort of issue, an elementary student issue, a water issue, a flowers issue. You could just frame it and frame it.
Absolutely, right, because it encompasses everything. So in a way, it's about being curious about other people and not feeling like you need to turn them into an environmentalist to be concerned about this, because people can care about the same thing for different reasons.
Right. Yeah, for so long, climate activism was thought to be the province of environmentalists. And you're not an environmentalist, you said.
I'm not. I'm so grateful, right, that the environmentalists took it up because most people had nothing to do with it. But I come to my climate work from a human rights perspective and a social justice perspective. I definitely care about the environment, and obviously we need it. But there are a lot of people who aren't environmentalists. And if we keep on saying this is just a green issue or an environmental issue, it's actually much, much bigger than that. And that will help many more people to see that they have skin in the game. And that's the key. When I first got involved with climate work, I was so alarmed by climate change. I actually took a year off to study climate science and communication. And I despaired because virtually every other message was, we need to do it for the children and the grandchildren and the polar bear. And I thought, you know, I don't have any children or grandchildren. Could you give me another reason? And I found that people just couldn't come up with other reasons why we need to do this. And I think that one of the things is we need to have thousands and thousands of reasons why we need to act so that, you know, everyone has a reason to be involved in this. Mm-hmm. Come in. But I think for a lot of people, they have to wrap their head and their heart around this thing because it is massive. Yeah, you could talk about the millions and millions of people. It's much easier to envision one person, you know, who's affected and to understand that. And if it's a person that they really care about or a place they really care about or an activity they really care about, they may become curious. And then that may make them curious to know more about the issue. It's really just the on-ramp, but it is one to get them to put down their guard, lower their defenses, because we've had a lot of defenses about climate change and for good reason. This, again, is not just an environmental problem. This is an existential problem. It is a problem where we're letting people know that as a species, we are at risk. That is not an easy message for people to take in. And we need to understand that, you know, the emotional needs that people have when they're hearing these climate messages, our brains are just not wired correctly for this kind of threat. So they automatically almost shut down in self-protection. And I know when I speak to an audience, I have to recognize that their emotional needs are as important as any intellectual need they have. And if I fail them on their emotional needs, if they feel at, you know, just so overwhelmed, so threatened, then they're not going to hear a word I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it make sense to go back to Mr. Bofuzio and talk about solutions to the coffee problem?
What I love about that monologue is it can crack open a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of issues around coffee anyway, with a lot of justice issues, a lot of issues around immigration and migration. It's just a great opening for lots of different things that we can talk about, including what do we need to do, you know, to help with coffee leaf rust. But I think it's, again, finding out what are people, where are people's hearts at? And, you know, what do they want to know about the coffee situation? More importantly than finding, you know, these solutions for these individual things, I think it's important for people to find their role. Like, what can I do about it? And that's, you know, after a good climate presentation, that's what people often ask. What do I do about it? And that's, in a way, the place you want to get people. The problem is, so often what the answer they get is so piddly in compared to the problem you just described that it almost doesn't make sense. There's this like cognitive dissonance. You're talking about the end of the world and these major things. And then people say, well, what can I do? Well, you could lower your personal carbon footprint, you know, maybe get an electric car, drive less, recycle, compost, go vegan. And I'm sorry, but the solution doesn't match the problem. And people know that in their gut. They're like, this is bull. This doesn't make sense, what you're telling me. And I think that's another part of the question is giving people really meaningful answers that will make a difference. And that's when it gets more challenging, but it's not impossible.
When I met you, you were giving a breakout session at a climate advocacy conference. And I didn't actually meet you because it was oversubscribed and people were flowing out into the hallway and I couldn't get in and I was pissed. But I said, I need to meet this guy later. And what you were doing is talking about the use of humor and story as these people who were advocates go about having their meetings with elected officials and pressing them on taking up climate in their next piece of legislation, what have you. What you were doing was saying, choose coffee or whatever as your thing and use that as a personal way of talking to elected officials.
Absolutely. I mean, because again, you make a connection with a person. If they love coffee too, great. If you say, I'm going to just come here and talk about climate change. Well, okay, that's massive. But if you say, you know, I'm into climate change for lots of reasons, but you know, it may sound silly, but part of it is coffee. They're going to remember that. In fact, I was asked to do the Joey Bofuzio monologue for a lawmaker who loved it. He's like, this is the funniest thing I've heard all week. They don't hear funny stuff all the time, these folks. So that was, but they'll remember, they'll be curious, but it's just an entry point. And so it all depends on who you're talking to, right? I mean, a lawmaker, you're going with a specific goal for them to pass legislation and you're trying to give them compelling reasons. Most of us don't have those opportunities. Most of our conversations are with family and friends, neighbors, that sort of thing. And here's the one thing that is challenging to do, but is very powerful. You can talk about the impacts of climate change, even on the things that people love. But what really motivates people, what really gets them excited, what really gets them to want to maybe even join a group, is if you can talk about the impact of climate solutions. If you can begin to talk about how the world will be different once we're off fossil fuels, and, you know, yes, even with the impacts of climate change that are hard baked in, but if you can begin to talk about this new world that we're trying to move towards, that can get people super excited. Time and time again, researchers are saying that talking about the impacts of solutions is a very, very powerful way of getting people engaged.
Let's see, before we go to a break, I just wanted to get personal again or serious again. Another reason I wanted you on my show is because I had found out that I knew your husband, Glenn, And I knew him back in the 90s when AIDS was just decimating both the gay community and the drug using community. I was in New York City, so was Glenn, and we traveled in the same circles. And this was such an intense time. So I figured he was family then, so you're family now. But you've talked a bit about that AIDS is a kind of a precedent for climate change. It's an existential issue.
Yeah. In my own climate work, traveling to the past has been very helpful. And I have been so moved by the fierce and creative work of these early HIV/AIDS activists. Think of the comparison here. You've got an issue that potentially could impact everyone, but was first impacting a particular marginalized group of people and other marginalized groups of people. You had a government that seemed to care less and a public that didn't want to hear it and was terrified. It sounds like climate change, but it was HIV/AIDS. And they were so, I don't know, I mean, nobody was perfect, but they made so many powerful, good choices. One, to humanize the experience, to try to raise empathy through the arts, through filmmaking and storytelling and film and quilts and, you know, all sorts of things to humanize the experience. But they also recognized that they had to change policy. It wasn't enough to change hearts and minds. They had to change laws. And so today, we actually benefit from some of the laws they changed. The doctor-patient relationship has changed dramatically because of some of the work these early HIV/AIDS activists have done. And they were able to change the way drugs were tested, all kinds of things. Of course, they were able to change policy for patients with HIV/AIDS. So there are so many lessons that we can pull from it. And I love the book and the documentary, How to Survive a Plague, because it pieces together some of that history, at least in the US, but that similar histories in the UK and other parts of the world, where these often young, inexperienced, fierce, very much afraid yet fearless people took on systems, demanded change, and then worked to come up with solutions and worked with all kinds of people who helped out, including Dr. Fauci was one of the people who was, you know, moved by this work.
Next up, after a musical break, maybe you have been thinking about climate change for a decade or more, or a minute or more. Either way, we all have a lot of big feelings about it. Peterson will take us there with the help from some friends and the 5 stages of hot climate action. I'm Julie Handman here on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and streaming at tacomaradio.org. My guest is the climate activist, performer, podcaster, Peterson Toscano. Climate change is no joke, and neither are the feelings we get when we think, talk, read about it. I really like, Peterson, your 5 stages of hot climate action, and thank you so much for offering to perform it live for us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wrote this monologue because I don't know about you listening, but it wasn't like, oh, climate change. Okay, cool. Let me work on that. I had to go through some real emotional work. And so these are the 5 stages of hot climate action. And since I'm a character actor, I can assign a character to each of the stages. So stage 1 is the freak out stage. That's, you know, of course, when the penny drops and you realize this is a big deal. And for some reason, the freak out stage sounds a lot like my dad, Pete Toscano, who's from the Bronx, who's a lot like Joey Bufuzio. Holy guacamole, global warming is going to crush us. Flood, drought, pestilence, whatever that is, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water, we're going to hell in a handbasket. After freaking out for a time, though, the pendulum swung the other way, and I began to toy with denial. I never, ever came right out and denied climate change, but it was tempting, and denial sounded a little like this.
Yes, of course, climate change is serious, but perhaps it will not be a catastrophe. I mean, we actually could use a little bit of warming in Siberia. They're still making bend something. This could just be another Y2K.
Then I couldn't deny reality any longer. And then I suddenly felt so ashamed and guilty because I'm part of the problem. My entire lifestyle is soaked in fossil fuels. So then I tried a personal purge to purge myself of all greenhouse gases. So I changed all my light bulbs. I bought those super expensive light bulbs. And then I stopped washing my my clothes in the dryer, partly because I couldn't afford to after all those expensive light bulbs. And then when this radical vegan activist with really bad breath screamed at me, I became a vegetarian for about a month. But then it hit the despair when I realized that my individual efforts and your individual efforts, they all added up, didn't come anywhere near to meeting the problem. And despair sounded a little bit like this. But what difference does it make? I purged myself dry. Nobody seems to care. And even if they did lower their own personal carbon footprints in the sand, it's like a teardrop in the ocean, which is quickly acidifying. The very roads they build for us, the entire infrastructure, is soaked in fossil fuels. It's like the trials of Job. Just curse God and die. I don't know why my despair voice sounds so biblical, but it does. But then something happened. I began to meet like-minded people who were concerned, but they were engaged. And action is an antidote to despair. They were determined. And that's what this sounds like. We live in extraordinary times, so much danger, uncertainty, and fear. But this is not our first rodeo. Our ancestors faced myriad challenges together. The Great Depression, World War II, the HIV/AIDS crisis. They discovered a lesson that we are learning today. We are not alone. We have each other. To encourage each other, to comfort each other, to bind our voices together, and together, dear friends, we shall do the extraordinary.
Thank you, Peterson. I love that. I love hearing those voices instead of just hearing a person list all of these things. It must really wake up your audiences. And I wish we had a call-in function here at the studio and we'd hear back. Do you feel like you've gone through those five and are sitting in hope? Or are you on only one or on many stages?
I definitely have moved through these stages. And I came to the conclusion that hope is a false stage. That the last stage I thought was hope, but I think it's more courage and determination. Because hope, it's one of those flighty feelings, right? I could feel hopeful, and then the next minute I can feel despair. And being on that hope-despair binary is not very helpful. So I take myself off the binary. I'm not big into binaries to begin with. And I said, you know what? I may feel like crap. I may feel hopeless, but this is the right thing to do regardless. This still has to be done. And I'm not a parent, but I often think of my sister, when she had her first child and this baby was just screaming its head off, she was exhausted, overworked. Her husband was working, couldn't be at home. And I'm sure she didn't feel really happy about having a child every second, but still that little life needed help. And I think it's like that with the climate movement. There's some days we're just not going to feel it. And if we're waiting for the feelings to kick in, well, forget it. We just need to be determined and the feelings will come. But the key, I think, is not doing it alone. And it is one of those things that we really do need the support and the comfort of our peers.
Yes, yes. We'll get more to that in the next segment. I get what you're saying. I also agree. Hope has to really absorb quickly into a larger sense of purpose and action, for sure. I think you can feel better when you're in action. So hope is a funny word and a funny thing to feel because it can feel paper thin. And while people get it, that retiring coal and gas as a source of our fuel and other critical ways to decrease our carbon footprint and methane footprint, it's all important, but it's hard to actually relate to. It's hard to go in and lobby on too. Please, you know, support clean energy. More to the heart of it, I suppose, is please protect my community. And that's really called adaptation. But a lot of people don't cling to that and don't spend a lot of time on that. But you say that's changing.
I see it changing. I also think it's really important to consider Mitigation work, of course, is essential, particularly in the United States, because we have been holding the entire world hostage in many ways by dragging our feet on this. And so there needs to be people lobbying Congress, bringing lawsuits, protesting, demanding action. There needs to be people doing that, no question about it. But it's not for everybody. And it's not all the work that needs to be done. And so I think part of it is trying to figure out, like, what do you have the stomach for and what are you really geared for? Are you more interested in doing things locally in your community? And I know some people have done that with trying to stop pipelines and all. But one of the big things that we can have a huge and very important impact on in our communities that will also promote equality and equity and justice is to talk about how are we going to prepare for the shocks of these storms and the extreme heat and all the other impacts of climate change. Because even if we are 100% successful in decarbonizing the world from fossil fuels in our energy sources, we still have the consequences of all the pollution that is built up. So whatever we can do locally to prepare for that is really, really critical. I mean, every city, municipality has all kinds of disaster plans, but they may not always consider everyone. You know, what about, you know, people with mobility issues? You know, what about people who have autism? If you have a particular interest or knowledge base, you actually have something to offer your community. I even go back to pets again. And I do this because, again, lots of people have pets. And one of the big risks in a big storm or a big event where people have to evacuate is they don't want to, because they can't leave their pet behind. There are horror stories of pets that were left behind in New Orleans when people thought they'd be back in a day or two, and they were never able to go back. So people hang out because they know in many places you can't take your pet with you to emergency shelter, and they don't realize that there is an emergency pet shelter available. And so just getting involved in that work, just making sure it's well-stocked, it's well-resourced, there are volunteers, that's something I can do starting today. I mean, like right now, even as we're speaking, someone could Google and say, emergency pet shelter in Tacoma, and find out where it is. Dr. Natasha DeJarnett, who is a public health expert who I've had on Citizens Climate Radio many times, you know, she talks about how important it is to have close-knit, cohesive communities. If a community is very close before an extreme weather event, more people survive and people recover faster. And so one of the biggest jobs in facing a changing climate is community building work.
Beautiful. Next up, after a musical break, like Peterson's British character said, we are not alone. We have each other to comfort, to join our voices together. Finding like-minded people and calling others out on the need to come into your community to act with you on these issues. That will round out today's episode. This is Climate Seasons on Tacoma Radio, 94.3 FM, WOWDLP, with your host, Julie Hantman, and my guest today, climate educator, performer, Peterson Toscano. Peterson, you have done a ton of podcast interviews, but we found short clips from two of those interviews. People who are all about finding their people and calling others to act. Can you tell us who we are about to hear?
You're first going to hear from Robin Boardman, who's from the UK. He's part of a group called Extinction Rebellion, and he doesn't play around. When I interviewed him, that was soon after they had shut down the city of London, and he was in charge of one of the bridges. And for many hours, they just sat and took over the streets. And it was powerful. And some of the activities went on for an entire week. So he's going to talk about systems change. In fact, the first words he'll say you can't quite catch is he'll say how systems change happens when civil disobedience encounters a system that is so toxic. And then he talks about the need to disrupt that.
Just to clarify for folks, civil disobedience, what it looks like. It looks a lot like Selma.
Yeah, it's non-violent direct action.
And you'll, from era to era, we see this. We see that it can have a great impact. Okay, let's go.
Systems change when civil disobedience encounters a system that is so toxic and it disrupts And some people will get mad by that, and other people will join it because they realize that these people are dedicated and they've been prepared to do what it takes to make something happen. So building on the research of people like Erica Chenoweth, who recognized that we need 3.5% of the population mobilized in order to create a system change. Our first demand to the government is to tell the truth about the climate crisis, about the ecological emergency, and act as if that truth is real. You know, what I feel is this deep sense of purpose with those around me, within coordinating XR and with all the local groups and others that I've worked with, is that we are working towards something greater than ourselves, and that we can commit ourselves fully to that. And that's a beautiful thing.
I love that, Peterson.
And if people want to hear the whole interview, it's episode 34 of Citizens Climate Radio. It's very powerful, very moving.
I loved it. I interviewed a journalist who covered the Extinction Rebellion DC chapter's actions a year or so ago in DC. People here may have recalled seeing photos of a pink boat that had been pulled by activists, made and then pulled by activists to the center of a major intersection downtown. So disrupting for sure, making your point for sure. It was heartening to me, even though I don't necessarily lean that way, towards seeing the civil disobedience movement grow around climate. It hadn't really been there until a few years ago, I think. We need everyone, though. To me, it's an ecology. It's an ecology.
That's right.
Of movement, of activism and action. Yeah.
And we have different roles. I mean, some are rebels, some are organizers, some are helpers, some are advocates. You know, if we all were rebels, then there'd be no one to talk directly to the lawmaker and, you know, work out what needs to be done. It's super powerful what they do. The other thing I think that makes them so effective is they really use art and theater really well, very much like the HIV ACT UP activists did. That pink boat, for instance, they do a lot of powerful visual storytelling, and they work with artists to make their message really effective.
Yes. Peterson, let's set up the next fellow.
Yeah, I was so excited to interview Tony Campolo, Reverend Tony Campolo. You know, in America, there are lots of people who maybe are holding back on climate change. It's changing, but still, one of the biggest groups that are most resistant still are white evangelicals. So I thought, you know what? I need to talk to a white evangelical who maybe cares about this issue. Turns out Tony Campolo wrote a book back in the 90s about creation care and about global warming, as we called it back then. So I followed up with him. I said, you know, you talked about this back then. What do you have to say now? And oh my goodness, he let loose. He was so displeased with his own people. It became like this powerful, almost like prophetic message. And so this is just a 1 minute clip of a very, very powerful conversation.
We have propagated a message of Christianity that calls upon us to exercise domination. We are so anthropomorphic and so human-centered that we think that the whole universe exists for our benefits and we have every right to exploit it for our own enjoyment, and nature be damned as long as it serves our well-being. To not be caring for the environment, to not worry about what's happening to the atmosphere, to not be concerned about climate change is to violate the admonitions of God. Do read all the books on this subject, and then do what I think the Bible calls you to do, to respond to the suffering planet and to rescue it from degradation.
Does he have a flock, Peterson, a climate flock, if you will?
No, he has a huge following. I mean, he has written scores of books, and he speaks all over the country, all over the world. Many people listen to him. He's much older now. He's in his 80s. He actually had a stroke a few months back, so he's taking it easy. But when Tony Campolo speaks, a lot of people listen. And I was really grateful to get him to speak so forcefully about this issue.
Yeah. Bob Inglis is another figure, more on the secular Republican, getting the Republicans on board. But people may not know that there's a lot of movement among sectors that you may not think are going to be bullish on climate action.
My two most popular episodes of Citizens Climate Radio is one that is, What Does the Bible Say About Climate Change? Where I actually spoke with three different evangelicals about creation care and climate change. And more recently, one, Climate Change and Creation Care, What Would Jesus Do? So many people daily are doing Google searches and find those episodes. And so in part, I put them out there because I wanted people to hear that there are people like them who have similar values and ideas who care about this issue and can put it into terms that they understand according to their worldview. People listen to people of whom they trust. And so if they won't listen to me, that's fine. I will find someone they will listen to.
Mm-hmm. You're a Bible scholar and formerly were evangelical. Is that correct?
That's right. I was born-again, evangelical, conservative for many, many years. I was also anti-gay, which was complicated because I am gay. But I know that world backwards and forth. And I know that there's a real depth of humanity to folks that are in that world that often doesn't get displayed through their theology or in public statements. And, you know, in many ways, they believe they're doing the right thing. And so... how do you appeal to people who want to make the world a better place, but on a very different agenda? And one thing that's really powerful is when we talk about the sanctity of the earth and how, you know, we need to return it to its, you know, kind of a holy place. This is language, of course, most secular folks and progressive folks don't like to use, but for this group, it's very powerful, meaningful language. What you're doing is really important because if we let the news curate our climate information, you know, they just are like, it's disaster porn. You know, that's what they're into. And it's also about backbiting and fighting and all this. And we need to be aware of this, but we need to also recognize that there are people really working hard and there are things happening. That's why I like Yale Climate Connections. They do a little like 30-second, or I guess 90-second little promo thing about something happening in climate change. And in my own podcast, Citizens Climate Radio, I now have a good news report. It's just a 3-minute section just to let people know, like, something that's happening on a local level or a state law that passed, an initiative that's really making a difference. That's, for those of us who are doing this work, we need to, you know, look at those stories. I don't like watch those really dire documentaries. They're not helpful to me typically. If I get a little like lackadaisical and I feel like I'm like, you know, whatever, need a shot in the arm, I'll watch one of those. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's really, really bad. Because we live in a world that downplays it. But for those of us doing this work, we need to protect our hearts. We need to protect our heads and our bodies. We need the self-care. We need to do to our bodies what we want people to do to the planet.
It has been such a pleasure talking to you today, Peterson. Thank you so much for coming on to my show.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Julie. I love that you're doing this, and I think your audience is really fortunate to have the show, and I hope they reach out to you and tell you how much they love it because you're doing a great job.
No, thank you. Peterson, do you want to name a couple of the websites that contain your work?
Yeah, the easiest way to find me is my website, petersontoscano.com. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram and on TikTok even, because I like doing silly things. But just go to petersontoscano.com. And my podcast, Citizens Climate Radio, is available wherever you get podcasts. I also host another podcast called Bubble and Squeak, which is my own personal audio playground where I get to be super silly and super serious at the same time.
And check out my past episodes, not to duel with you here, my past episodes of Climate Seasons Radio at my website, climateseasons.org. That's climateseasons, all one word, .org. And yes, a huge thank you to Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM for allowing this show onto their airwaves for nearly 3 years. Thanks so much.